This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila, and we are Spy Fat Chicks. And this week's episode is going to be about The Botany of Desire by Michael Pollan. It's a book review, so sit back, relax, and listen.
And then go to Amazon or someplace and buy it.
Or your local bookstore.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I should recommend local first. My bad. Go local, unless it's electronic. Then go to whatever electronic source you use to purchase your books and get it. Go ahead.
So we were just looking up to try and find out what year this came out in relation to Omnivore's Dilemma. And this is actually Michael Pollan's first food-related book. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of gardening stuff in it, and the reason why you got turned on to this was because of Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Yes.
Because they talk a lot about gardening, because Jefferson was a huge gardening guy.
Gardening and, geek.
Yeah.
The man kept he kept garden logs. Diaries and logs, and yeah. He was intense.
He was totally about doing this amateur research thing to try and find out the best way to grow whatever.
Mm-hmm. And there was an episode where they were talking, or rather Clay Jenkinson, out of character as Thomas Jefferson, was talking about The Botany of Desire. Because Botany of Desire talks about four plants. And I have to say this to put this in context of the episode of Thomas Jefferson Hour. But it talks about apple trees, marijuana, tulips, and potatoes. And there is this particular movement amongst those who enjoy marijuana that insists that Thomas Jefferson was this huge pothead. There is no historical evidence to support that.
We'll never know. Yeah.
But there's really no historical evidence to support it. So whenever he's doing his Thomas Jefferson thing, he gets invited all the time by these marijuana activist groups who want him to come and speak as Thomas Jefferson. And he's like, all right, but you're not going to like what I have to say.
Yeah.
And he was talking about that, and then he segued off into The Botany of Desire and what a great book it was. And it has this whole chapter about the history of it. So it caught my interest. I'm like, that sounds like a pretty cool book, especially the stuff about the apple trees. So we ended up going on to Kobo Books and buying a copy. We are big fans of the electronic format because we do both have e-readers, and with Kobo Books, we can both read them at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we can kind of race, which is what
these. We can talk about it while we're reading it as well.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about trying to share bookmarks. But what surprised me was that Omnivore's Dilemma came out in 2006, and I thought it was so much earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we were talking about the other day was whenever you read Omnivore's Dilemma, I think we covered this in that episode too. It's kind of dry because you've read everything that's derived from it.
Mm-hmm.
Food Inc., even the 100-mile diet,
yeah,
all that stuff. It goes back to Omnivore's Dilemma, and that's when it was really earth-shaking and really out there ideas. But the more all these things have sprung up around us. When you go back to the original source and read it, it's a little bit of a labor of love.
Well, we started doing the podcast in 2009, and a lot of what we have read and looked at from 2009 to now, those either films or pieces of literature are the intellectual descendants of the Omnivore's Dilemma in some way or another.
But my point was, Botany of Desire is a lot more of a lively read. It's a shorter read, and it's very interesting, and it seems a lot more easy reading, I guess.
And it was published in 2001.
Yeah.
So this predates all of the Omnivore's Dilemma stuff. And in the chapter about potatoes, you can really see which way he's heading and how he got from Botany of Desire to Omnivore's Dilemma.
Mm.
This book has made me a huge Michael Pollan fan. I was kind of keen on him before. I really, really liked this book better than Omnivore's Dilemma.
Yeah.
It was fantastically well done.
Yeah. I know that Omnivore's Dilemma is going to be like his magnum opus.
Yeah.
Because it really did change everything.
And it's going to be what he's remembered for. But don't neglect this one. If you're a big fan of Omnivore's Dilemma and you haven't read this yet, pick it up. We're going to use the same format we do anytime we're talking about books. We're going to go chapter by chapter. There's really only four chapters in it.
Yeah. So. But it still should make for an interesting episode. Yeah.
The whole concept of this book is to look at plants in a different way. We always look at plants as
very passive and almost like the victim in any kind of relationship that they're going to have.
And as he puts it, a gardener is the master in his own domain. He decides what lives. He decides what he's going to plant. It's all the gardener. Me, 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 me. I want this. I want that. I'm putting these seeds in the ground because I want this plant. And Michael Pollan kind of twists it and says, how do we know these plants aren't manipulating us? So yeah. He does a little anthropomorphizing on the plants, which is kind of cool in a way.
Well, and who's to say that it's not true, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that the plants have specifically designed themselves to attract us.
Us, and get us to propagate them. And that's the theme he follows the entire book. He takes four plants that have become very entwined with human history, and he talks about how they fooled us into making them spread everywhere.
It's kind of like, literally, the cat's meow.
Yeah.
Because cats don't meow in the wild. They meow because people find that noise delightful. We love it to hear the cats meow, so they meow. We pet them. They get what they want. But
exactly.
They're doing it, basically, to get something from us.
Yeah. But it's really, really cool. And it's not like a drastic shift in how you think, but it puts a twist on it. You're like, oh yeah, that is kind of manipulative, you darn plants. Meanwhile, you know, we spend, what, how many millions of dollars a year trying to eliminate dandelions?
Yeah.
So they are not enticing us to make them spread in any way, shape, or form, unless you're 6 years old. Then there's nothing more fun than running into a field with them and kicking the little seeds everywhere. Then they are manipulating us. So we can add that to a footnote of The Botany of Desire. So he, each plant he assigns like a particular emotion to, or a motivation.
Yeah.
So for apples, it was sweetness. For tulip, it was...
Was it beauty?
I think it was beauty. Sheila, however, has her handy-dandy little Kobo here in the search feature in the index, so she's going to go take a look at the chapter names real fast.
The apple was sweetness, the tulip is beauty, marijuana is intoxication, and the potato is control.
So we're just going to go chronological down the line here. Apples.
I loved the apple chapter. Oh. It was probably my favorite. And I guess it's just because we're such history geeks. It's dispelling a lot of the propaganda.
It's very lies my teacher told me.
Yeah, because Johnny Appleseed has been completely whitewashed into this do-gooder...
Disney-ified.
Yes.
There's a Disney cartoon about him, and that's what, at least everybody my age in the States, we grew up watching that. You guys probably saw it up here, too.
Yep, that's why we know that he wore a potato sack and...
Had the hat on his head.
He had a pot on his head, yeah.
So, as you can tell already by how we're talking, the apple chapter talks a lot about Johnny Appleseed and what he did for modern apples. And it was really cool. He did a giant freaking just, like, game of 52 pickup with apples and apple genetics. Apples, and I didn't know this until I read the book, apples, if you grow an apple from a tree from a seed, that tree will have almost nothing in common with the parent apple. Literally, the apple falls far from the tree.
Yeah. The seed will basically, it'll run its random calculation, whatever it is, and pick something from apple genetics. You have no idea what you're going to get.
Yeah, it's
a roulette wheel. Like a little tiny and small, like a crab apple. It could be big and huge and plump and juicy, like a Macintosh.
It could be mealy. It could be really tart. It could be anything. It could be funky colored. It could be all randomly gnarled and stuff.
Yeah.
There's almost an infinite variety that could come out from that. So if you want to propagate the same apple over and over on these different trees, you have to graft them.
Yeah.
When Johnny Appleseed had his giant sack of seeds and he set out into the wilderness, he wasn't doing that. He was planting them literally in the wild, just from seed, and he was doing it to prepare land for when new settlers came in, and he would sell the trees.
Yeah, and he wasn't actually doing it for eating them. He was doing it for drinking
them. Because these random apples that you get that are wildlings, they're good for mostly one thing, and that is cider.
Yep, you can crush it, you can ferment it, and it's safe to drink.
Yes.
Just like most alcoholic beverages back then, compared to anything else you're going to drink.
And the cider they would be drinking would be very comparable to small beer. It would not be a very high alcohol content cider.
We're talking like, what, 2-3% maybe alcohol?
Four would really be maxing it out. But if you want something higher alcohol percentage, guess what you do with it then?
You throw it in the freezer and make Applejack.
And if you don't have a freezer...
That's similar to how you're doing ice beer, or leave it out in the wintertime, right?
That's what they would be doing. You pull the ice out of it, and you automatically raise the alcohol content of the beverage.
Because you're basically...
something between 20 and 40%.
You're cold distilling it, because you're getting rid of all the water.
Yes. Which, if you make mead, and you end up with a really nasty batch of mead, you can do that to at least salvage something out of it as well. And then you can use that as a base for cordials. Just saying. Anyway.
Maybe that's why we like this chapter so much, is because it's alcohol-related.
So Michael Pollan goes and sets off to find out the roots, haha, no pun intended, of Johnny Appleseed and the real story behind him. He hooks up with a guy who's really into the Johnny Appleseed as like a Christian evangelist, because Johnny Appleseed was religious. but not as the Christian type we think now. He was very much more like a...
like tent revivalist?
Not really, because he was very much into that Christian sect that he was talking about, where you became closer to God by being closer to nature.
Yeah.
So he was a crazy dude.
Well,
crazy-eyed,
yeah.
Wild guy, and people just liked him, though. He was very disarming.
He didn't seem dangerous.
Yeah.
He seemed, like, relatively harmless kind of thing. But if you look at it, he was nuts, man.
Yeah.
And possibly a pedophile.
Yeah.
Like, because he was supposed to marry this 10-year-old girl, and
well,
I don't know.
He was waiting until she got older.
Right.
He was engaged to her when she was 10, and then when she got older and started flirting with other boys, he said, oh, she's not worth my time now.
Yeah.
So, but he was chased. He didn't do anything. There's no records of anything bad. There are all kinds of records of this guy all over, though, the frontier.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, at the time, the frontier was like, you know, Western Ohio, Indiana, that kind of thing. But really cool chapter. Michael Pollan makes the comparison or the connection between Dionysus and Johnny Appleseed and how they're pretty much the same kind of concept of person. That's what we've...
Mm-hmm.
But we hide the Johnny Appleseed thing with Applejack and apple cider and everything. But, oh, what he did for apples, though, is because he planted all these wild trees and they started self-pollinating and everything all over the place with each other, he created this potential, because once they're that big, you can't graft them, for all of these new varieties of apples to pop up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And because he had all these random apple trees out there from all these random seeds... That's where we get the basis for all of the American apple types we have.
Mm-hmm.
He created the roulette wheel for us to spin to get our apples today.
Basically, he did, and I'm going to link this first chapter to the last chapter. He did for apples what the Mayans did for potatoes.
Yes.
Because they were all about biodiversity, even though they didn't have that word.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of these groups of people had that word, but that's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
It was throw it out there and see what happens.
Yeah.
And the more diverse you have of a crop, the better chances are you're going to be able to make sure you can live off of it.
Yeah. Oh, another reason why apple cider was so important, totally forgot to bring this in. At the time, there were no varieties of American grapes. American grapes were not doing very well at all, not to the point where you could really make any decent wine out of them.
They hadn't really gotten to California yet.
Yeah, in the Niagara region just wasn't doing it yet. So, and now we know you can grow grapes, and we have modern techniques to make it possible to have a vineyard in many, many places.
Well, you can pick this specific variety of grape
that'll grow into
that thing. But
not quite as possible at the time. So cider was the American wine, and it was very important for that reason as well. The sad part is that through modern mass marketing, and we were talked about this way back in Last Chance to Eat.
Yes.
About how modern apples have gone the exact opposite route of what Johnny Appleseed was doing, and we've almost let entire strains die out because
right.
we want that big, perfect red apple with no taste.
Yeah, who cares what it tastes like as long as it looks pretty on the shelf, right?
Yeah. Now, there was that one farm that he was talking about where they're trying to preserve all these different strains of apples to the point where if you want seeds to plant, as long as you promise to plant and send them whatever happens, maybe send them some seeds back from what you end up with, that they're willing to do that. So that, I thought, was really cool. If you want more information about that, you know what? Buy the book. Because it's worth it.
Yeah.
It really motivated me when we buy a house. I kind of want to try to grow a couple apples from seeds.
Sure.
And I want to get the apples from that tree in our front yard of our apartment building.
Okay.
Because where we live in Oshawa, it used to be orchards. And there's still a couple trees in the area from those orchards. There's this, I want to say single apple tree, but it's two different types of apples. Did you notice that?
It's two trees that have grown together.
And I think they pollinate between the two of them.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's pretty cool. I think that was done on purpose by whoever planted them.
Possibly.
So they always have this cross-pollination thing going on. But I kind of want to, when we move, grab a bunch of those apples because we know they're not going to be genetically locked down to where they can't reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to try to do some trees out of those seeds.
Sure.
I think that would be so cool. So, awesome chapter. Oh, totally eye-opening about, even more so than how our eyes were open when we read Last Chance to Eat.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've not listened to the episode about Last Chance to Eat, it is way back in, I think, our first year we started doing the podcast.
Yeah.
We're coming up
on our three-year anniversary.
We are, this spring. It's a really good book, really recommended by Gina Mallett.
Gina Mallett.
Go listen to the episode. Go check out getting the book. You can probably pick it up for a song almost anywhere now. It's one of those books that are in the discount rack. Worth it. On to the tulip.
This was interesting just because of the financial thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
Maybe first, think of Pokemon.
Yeah. Well, there was all these, like, crazy tulip speculators that ended up crashing the economy in Holland because they were speculating on what the price of the bulbs was going to be.
Uh-huh.
And they ended up... Did something end up happening to the tulips?
No. No, it was just one day, literally, they were having an auction, and all of a sudden everybody just stopped bidding.
They just got tired of it.
This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And this was in the 1600s in Amsterdam. And it's just that tulips did well in Amsterdam because they had very small gardens. So they got to the point where instead of having these massive rolling gardens with all these other terrain and plants tied into it, kind of like an English garden, you had to work with what you had, something very small. So they would focus on having one or two really amazing centerpiece plants. And the tulip was very unique in terms of its the way its petals were, its bright colors. It was originally a Turkish plant, so it was exotic too at the time. Europe had seen nothing like it before.
Yeah.
And there was this particular phenomenon. It turned out it was actually a fungal infection that really was bad for the tulips in the long run. But it would cause what they call a break, where you'd have this like bright white or yellow tulip that would end up with these red streaks that would look like flames coming out of it almost. Mm. And that was very, very desired. And once you had that, those plants, they give off these, I forget what the word is for it, but these extra bulbs that you can pull off the plant.
Yeah, that's how it reproduces.
That's how you reproduce that exact same tulip with the break. The tulips with that break, due to the fungal infection, don't reproduce as many of those, and they're much smaller. So in the long run, they're pretty much genetically breeding themselves out. But all these Dutch people are saying, no, this is what we want, and they're trying to propagate them all over the place. So,
well, the other thing I didn't realize about tulips, because I figured that this was true of all bulb plants, was I didn't realize that tulips don't always come back every year.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I thought they did, but it's those new bulbs that are coming up every year.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas the old bulbs eventually just get used up and die out.
Yeah.
So it'll eventually, I guess, creep along the ground with the new bulbs giving off flowers and the old bulbs eventually wearing out in between.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting.
Yeah, I had no idea. I literally thought it was the same bulb over and over, but now it's those little offshoots that go up, and then their offshoots go up. So if you were to plant one tulip bulb and they all were to continue to regrow every year, you would see them growing away from that central spot where the original one was. And he talked about that black tulip.
The Queen of Night.
The Queen of Night. And how they're trying to always find the perfect tulip genetic code that would let them get the purest black tulip. But due to them using this one over and over and over, that it's almost died out as well. And they're trying to find the next black tulip. It's a really interesting chapter. I'm not a big fan of flowers. I like roses, and that's about it.
Right. But well, then, too, because you have to plant them all the time, there's actually a market for them all the time. If you want tulips in your garden, you have to keep putting them in every year. And I just like to throw out there, too, as a point of trivia, that because of how we helped in World War II, Canada has always gifted so many tulip bulbs by Holland on the anniversary of one of the battles that happened there.
Yeah, because we were someplace a few years ago and you pointed it out to me. You're like, oh, those are the gift from Holland every year. I'm like, what? And then she like explained it to me. I thought, that is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Good on you, Holland. But it's a really fascinating chapter. I really liked how he tied that together with marijuana too.
Yeah.
About how Holland's a place where they can take a plant and run with it and come out with all kinds of crazy stuff. So if you're into gardening and into plants in general, not so much the food end of the book, you're going to dig that chapter to no end. Yeah. Totally worth picking up the book just for that chapter. And another reason why we enjoyed this so much is we both really like books that look at a particular item and do a cultural history of it.
Yeah.
Or do a historical study of it. And we had four of those done in this book on four separate plants. That was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like to pick up, like, Salt is one of my favorite history books. I love that book to death. There was another one I read. The coffee book, as depressing as it was really good.
Cigarette Century?
I still have to get a copy of that. I can get that now on Cocoa Books.
Yes.
I should probably get that maybe this week.
All right.
I digress again. So,
the next chapter.
Da, da, da.
Reefer Madness, Reefer Madness, oh so mad. Where do we even start with this?
Okay. Michael Pollan is a huge gardener. Loves to garden, talks about his garden all throughout the book. And way, way back in his misspent days, he was given a couple weed plant seeds, marijuana plants, or seeds, and he thought, you know, let's see what happens with these. So he decided to grow them out behind his, like, it was like an old wooden shed or something.
It was like half of a barn.
Yeah.
Like, the roof was still intact, but it was missing a couple walls kind of thing.
Yeah. So he plants them out there, and these things go crazy.
They grow, like, taller than the barn.
And they smell funky, too. Apparently marijuana smells very bad when it grows. So he's doing that, and he orders some wood to be dropped off, like a cord of firewood. And the guy pulls up with it. He's like, oh, where do you want? He's like, oh, let's just go put it in the shed. That'll be the best place for it. He's like, yeah, so what do you do when you're not hauling lumber? He's like, actually, I'm the chief of police for the town. And Michael Pollan's like, he looks over at the shed, and he sees, like, the top of the weed plants poking out, because they got that big. They got, like, 10 feet.
They're, like, waving in the
air. He's like, oh, you know what? Just drop it right here in the driveway. The guy's like, are you sure? Looks at him like he's crazy. And he's like, yeah, really, drop it right here. This was in, like, 1981 or something.
Yeah.
So he drops that load. He goes to get more. When he goes to get the rest, Michael Pollan runs out, hacks down these giant weed plants. He said, like, they were, what, as thick as his wrist, the stalks?
Yeah, he had to use an axe to chop them down, so.
And there's a very good reason why they looked that way, too, and we'll talk about it. But he chopped them down, crammed them into garbage bags, and threw them in the attic.
All in, like, under 4 minutes.
Yeah. So that was awesome. But, and then he gets into the history of marijuana. Not, like, the old school, oh, it was brought to the continent and da-da-da-da-da stuff, but the history of the modern plant that's smoked for intoxicating purposes. When the American government decided to declare the war on drugs and they decided to sell their own marijuana. No, that might actually work better than the process they're using now. But when they decided to declare the war on drugs, they shut down all of the Mexican marijuana coming into the states. So people were forced to turn to growing their own stuff. Before, people grew their own, and it was looked at as, like, oh, that crap kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the particular type, the strain that they were growing was one that grew very tall and needed to be in a very hot environment. Think Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
There's this very specific Latin name for it that I have no brain to retain. I'm not good at retaining plant names.
Do you want me to look it up?
You can go look it up while I continue to expound, to babble about this. And my memory is usually not this good, but we just finished the book, I think, yesterday, so everything's still really fresh. So you have this strain that grows very, very tall and doesn't really produce much of what enthusiasts of the plant call bud, which is apparently what you want to smoke. You don't smoke the leaves, you smoke the flowers.
Well, before the flowers open.
Before the flowers open. And apparently you only want the female ones, because once they're pollinated from the male, it's just all downhill from there.
So the one type is the sativa, and the one other type is the indica.
Indica. And the sativa is the one that gets really, really tall, isn't
it? And it's very woody, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not as good. So,
but it's hardy.
It's very hardy. The short one,
indica, grows short, tall,
and bushy.
Short,
tall, and bushy.
Wait, sorry. The indica is the one that grows short and bushy.
Yeah.
And has the better quality.
Yes.
Bud, I guess.
So, and I'd also like to interject a personal story on this one. That story about the plant growing up over the shed.
I thought about that. Your neighbor, Dave.
When I was growing up, we had a neighbor in front of us. Our house was actually in a house behind another house, so we had, like, a really long driveway to get to the road, and back off where my parents live, our backyard ended in just, like, acres and acres and acres of wooded wilderness began. As Jefferson would call it, the howling wilderness. Mm. The howling wilderness is behind my parents' house. So, our neighbor, Dave, and he had this big shed and garage area. Somebody gave him some marijuana seeds. Now, we're talking about a very straight-laced, very Christian man who would never have more than one beer at a time. Elderly man. I mean, he was probably in his 60s around the time I was a kid.
And so he was always old?
Mm-hmm.
He was always that old guy?
Yeah, he was. Ever since I can remember, he was retired. And he was a huge gardening enthusiast, to the point where he would plant almost an acre of his own. And the garden that my dad used to plant was actually his property that he's told my dad, go ahead and plant. I'd rather see it used with something than just let it lie fallow. Mm. So that's where our family garden came from. And my dad planted a very large garden. The garden was the size of most people's house plots.
Yeah.
It was very big. And Dave's was probably the size of almost two or three house plots. To the point he actually had a tractor he would use for it.
Yeah.
He had a small tractor and he needed it. He would plant rows of corn. It was like growing up next to a miniature farm. You could almost sustain a family off of what that man grew for a year. If you were creative and canning, you could pull it off. He was so 100 mile before it was 100 mile. It was amazing. And he hunted too. So he was super 100 mile.
Yeah.
He was the one that there was a white buck, an albino buck, and he couldn't bring himself to shoot it because it was just gorgeous. And it had like a huge rack on it. And he just couldn't do it. He said, that's something that deserves to live.
Yeah.
So he put his gun down. So he got these marijuana plants, or seeds, and he decided to do the same thing. Because he just wanted to see what would happen.
Yeah.
Because it's so forbidden. He's like, you know, I'm curious.
Well, that's why Michael Pollan did it, too. Mm-hmm. He said, He did it just more for the gardener's curiosity kind of thing.
Yeah, and he was an enthusiast, so there was other motivation, but mostly out of gardening curiosity. My neighbor, on the other hand, just strictly out of sheer gardening curiosity. And it got as big. I remember my dad telling me it got bigger than Dave's shed. That's when Dave said, you know, I think I need to cut that down because you can see it from the road. So he cut it down, and then he threw it on his bonfire.
It stood upwind.
Yes.
Hopefully.
But it went all over the rest of the neighborhood, so hopefully everybody had a good day that day. Who knows? So back when the American Drug War was cracking down on this, and people only had the giant tall plants that weren't very good, another strain came in, which was the Indicus, that small leafy strain, which is much hardier, does much better in a colder climate. Not cold, but not as warm a climate.
Mm-hmm.
It can also be grown very well indoors. So then, enthusiasts of the plant decided to cross the two, and they made this, like, perfect marijuana plant. And a lot of people, when the drug war started, also went to Amsterdam mm-hmm. with this. And then they started doing even crazier things with it. And a marijuana plant can also be grafted like an apple tree. So if you have a particular strain that you've developed that you really like, you can graft it. And since it's the female plant that you want, because once it pollinates, the whole thing apparently goes to hell.
Yeah, you throw out all the male plants,
you throw out all the male plants. And once you get that particular strain, though, and you start grafting it, you're only going to get female plants because they're perfect genetic copies.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all the, you have these, like, Amazonian weed plants all over the place. Which, at one hand, you're looking at this chapter and thinking, he put that in here just to sell books. But once he starts to really get into the history of it, you see where it perfectly fits into the theme of the book.
Mm-hmm.
He has a little bit of a dirty hippie moment where he goes off on how, like, intoxication fits into finding a higher state of existing and all of that. And it was only a couple pages. You can suffer through it.
No, but that totally it supports fits. His yeah. argument that the plants make us do these things.
Exactly. So it supports it, but on the other hand, it's a little dirty hippie. You're like, eh, whatever. But the history behind the plant and how they crossbred it to that small leafy thing was
well, then you end up having, like, I don't know a huge amount about it, but I do know that there's different strains. Like, there's, and they have these colorful names, like the Maui Wowie.
Yeah.
Purple
Pineapple Haze Express.
And, yeah, exactly.
But, and it, I hate to base my my education of this off of, like, pop culture, but the only thing I had to compare it to was watching the TV show Weeds.
Yeah.
Because I know nothing about it. And it's one of those things, there's not a lot of documentation about it because it's all underground.
Yeah.
And he also made the comment about how the best gardeners of our generation are doing everything underground because they're all growing marijuana. Because
yeah.
it's a challenge. Not because it's a challenge, because it's profitable.
It's super profitable.
But people who have a knack for it, that's what they're doing. They're not growing tulips. They're not growing orchids. They're growing that.
So we could be having botanists that are curing cancer with different varieties of
But the money is where the
herbs.
Weed is, so that's yeah. where they are.
So they're growing a different kind of herb.
Yes. But absolutely fascinating, too. And how they found that the plant produced more buds when there was more UV.
Yeah.
So when they started hitting it with the higher UV lights, that they went crazy. And the particular strain that was that cross of the two, the more starved it is for pollen, the larger the bud gets because it's trying to stretch itself out further and further and further.
Trying to make a bigger and bigger cone to catch some pollen.
Exactly. So that gets, back into where the whole kill all the males comes from. Again, it just makes me think of, like, these Amazonian weed plants with one boob.
Yep.
I don't know. It's a very strange anthropomorphizing going on in my head right now. Interesting chapter. If you're into weed, perhaps picking up the book might be worth it just for that chapter. If you don't know anything about your hobby, you might learn something about it. Go you. The last chapter.
The
this
potato.
This one was probably my favorite.
Oh, yeah?
Wow. This may be one of the earliest books casting Monsanto in a negative light.
True.
Getting on the, oh my god, Monsanto is dirt evil bandwagon.
The, what is the terrible thing that we have wrought?
Yes, that's why I dug it.
Because eventually, any monster you create is going to turn on you and destroy some cities.
Monsanto's trying hard. So, the potato is a Mayan root.
Yeah, it comes from South and Central America,
mm-hmm.
and they had crazy amounts of potatoes. All different colors, all different kinds that would grow
Purple.
In all different environments. Up on slopes, at the bottom of the slope, rocky soil, fertile soil, anything
mm-hmm.
you could think of. The Mayans were totally about grow as many different things as possible. That way, if something takes one of these things out, we're not going to starve.
Mm-hmm. instead of a monoculture,
biodiversity is good.
Biodiversity. Well, potatoes came back to the New World, or came back to Europe, and they kind of did well in some places, but they really took hold in Ireland, because potatoes can be grown almost anywhere.
Yeah.
And they did really well in the rocky Irish soil, where most plants did not do well. So that's when Ireland had its population boom, because now the Irish could feed themselves. It became known as...
The lumper.
The lumper. Or also, like, the breadroot was one of the names for potatoes.
Yeah.
Because apparently, and I still need to do a little research on this, I haven't had a chance, but a potato combined with milk is almost what you need, vitamin-wise,
you
for the day. All the major ones.
You can pretty much survive off of that.
Mm-hmm. Almost. I'm sure you're missing a few other pieces, but there's protein.
But you can survive off of it for a while.
Exactly. Protein, there's vitamin C, vitamin E, some other stuff in it, and then milk brings in your vitamin D and a few other things. So between those two, you're doing pretty good compared to what the Irish peasant was existing off of before.
Which is probably like a horrible gruel.
Yes. Or whatever they could get their hands on.
Yeah.
Potatoes also helped pretty much eliminate scurvy in Europe because they're chock full of vitamin C. Don't believe me? Eating chips right now? Flip the bag over. There's vitamin C in there, and it's not put there by the manufacturer, and it's not brought in by the oil.
And it's actually a decent amount.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like 30% of what you need for the day or something.
Yeah. Well, it's 10% in a serving of potato chips, but when you look at a serving of potato chips, that's like an inch and a half of potato before it's fried.
If you were to eat a baked potato,
you're going to get a good chunk of what you need for the day. If you're an Irish peasant and existing off of potatoes in various forms, you're good, man. Your teeth are staying right where they are. Because processed sugar isn't affordable to you either yet.
Yes.
So there you go. So, the potato blight that forced a lot of Irish to immigrate to the United States was a fungus that only affected a particular variety of potato, which happened to be what was really popular in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a fungus, it turns the potato to sludge underground, and it also affects potatoes that have already been harvested. Yeah. So once these spores get into your fields, they're going to go to your storage and just wipe out everything.
Basically, it just floats through the air, and whatever it lands on, it infects.
Yeah.
Kind of like some sort of horrible zombie potato virus.
Yes. So fast forward to modern-day potato farming, and they have all of these things to combat because they're all growing one variety of potato. We, as a society, we haven't learned from these mistakes that happened 200, 300 years ago. And we're still saying, well, we want this perfect French fry. McDonald's wants this perfect French fry from these perfect potatoes. They only want one variety.
And because McDonald's is the one that's buying it,
largest,
that's what people make, you know? That's what people raise.
They are the largest potato buyer in the world. So their demand for that perfect, picture-perfect French fry is driving everything for the potato industry.
And you know, when I read the description of how that farmer's field looked, it made me weep inside.
The one fellow he goes to see, the field, the soil's like dust. It's coated in chemicals.
It's this gray, lifeless...
Looks like the moon.
Powder.
Yeah. Moon with little sprouts.
They should just grow it in the desert.
Yeah.
Like, grow it in sand. Because at least then you wouldn't be killing any soil.
And no groundwater will be affected either.
Yeah.
So, they have these different types of pesticides you have to put down for the potatoes. One's against the potato beetle. One's to keep the same thing, the blight... affecting, and one of them's for this other type of infection that makes spots appear on the russets, which is undesirable. I'm using quote air quotes here, undesirable in the eyes of McDonald's because the American public doesn't want spotted French fries.
Meh. I've actually seen the brown spots before and wondered what they were, and I figured since I hadn't died yet from eating them, they were okay.
Exactly. So there's all these things you have to put down. One in particular is a neurotoxin to the point when the farmer puts them down in the field, he won't, or his staff, aren't allowed to go into the field for up to 5 days. It's so powerful.
It has to, like, dissipate.
They're going to spray this open in the field where it can go anywhere. Oh, my God.
What the hell?
Then,
seriously.
One of the other farmers that he is talking to that does the Monsanto growing is talking about how they won't eat potatoes they pull out of their field until the end of the season because they have to let all the toxins leach out of the potato into the ground.
Yeah, that's some scary
wow.
stuff.
That's something else that you don't think of that sort of thing when you're talking about gardening. You don't treat your vegetation, your vegetables, like they need a half-life to the point, like radiation, where it has to decompose to the point it's safe to eat. You don't think of it like that. That is scary. The answer to this from Monsanto is this new potato called the New Leaf. The New Leaf has its own pesticides built in. It
and
repels
the pesticide
all of this.
That they're using is actually one that naturally occurs in the soil. It's called BT.
One they usually spray.
Yeah.
They usually spray it. Now it's in the potato itself. The potato is now classified as a pesticide. It's not governed by the FDA anymore. It's under the Environmental Protection Agency, correct, because of how it's classified. Again, scary, scary stuff.
Do I really want to eat that?
Mm-hmm. But the nice part about this is these farmers no longer have to spray all of this stuff on their fields. They only have to spray, like, one thing and that's it. Good for them, but on the other hand, oh.
Have they done tests to see if it actually builds up in your system? Mm-hmm. Who knows, right?
At the time of when this book was written and published in 2001, no testing had been done. BT? Is it BT?
Yeah, it's BT, like, capital B and a small t.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what it stands for, but it said that it was an antifungal, like, pesticide.
Yeah.
Antifungal, anti-microbe element that actually naturally occurs in soil.
Now, this pesticide, nobody's tested what happens with humans. Nobody has tested if it's safe for humans. In fact, under the EPA, that they only have to look into it is if the company comes to them and says, we don't think this is safe, could you please examine it? So they're expecting Monsanto, who, again, listen to previous episodes, go read a few books, you understand they're kind of dirt evil. And I'm going to explain why they're dirt evil in case you've forgotten. It's not because they're doing all this crazy genetic stuff. I am a total science geek, and on one hand, I'm like, we need to be very careful. On the other hand, I like scientific advancements, especially in the food sector, because that means we can feed more people. That's good.
But it's this how they're scary. Going about it.
It's not just that. It's that other gene they locked into things, the Germinator.
Yeah.
But that's down the road. So the new leaf, it's scary stuff. He ends up with a bag of, he gets some seedling potatoes from Monsanto. He buys them and he plants them in his own garden to see what happens. One of the other things they'll do is the one potato beetle, it kills them. They eat it, it like liquefies their insides and they die. So he plants them and they're just gone.
Yeah.
He does have a good crop of them. He harvests them and he's just not sure he wants to eat them.
He can't really in good conscience eat them, and he can't serve them to anybody that he's not going to tell what it is.
And who's going to eat them once they know.
Yeah.
That's kind of scary. Now, to go on further with Monsanto, one of the things we've talked about with Food Inc. is Monsanto has spliced a new gene in to a lot of their things that makes it impossible for the seed to reproduce itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's their way of protecting their intellectual property, because if you buy the seed from them, they own it. You can't replant it ever
again. I have
no
idea how this ever passed in the United States court system.
Yeah.
But they actually can patent and defend as like a copyright their genetic codes. But the problem is, if the pollen from this plant blows into somebody else's field and starts growing, they will go and actively sue them.
Yeah, and this has happened.
We're not being alarmist. This has actually happened.
Food Inc. talked about it a lot. Really good documentary. Check it out. I think it's on Netflix now.
Mm-hmm.
Totally check it out for more information on that or our past episode where we talk about it too. But what it still scares the snot out of me with this Terminator gene that keeps the seeds from reproducing is all of these farmers have to buy this pretty much to stay profitable.
And they have to buy it
every single year.
Because they cannot keep any of the seeds. Because
it's just not going to grow.
Well, what before happens, that, they couldn't glean any seeds, it was illegal for them to do so.
What happens in the face of a natural disaster? What's going to happen to farmers being able to plant if Monsanto, all of a sudden, for some disaster they have, can't produce the seed the next year? That is scary.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you're putting not just the American, but part of the world's food supply in danger. That is irresponsible, and that is selfish and greedy. And that is why I can sit here and say with a clear conscience and not feel like a total six-year-old doing it, Monsanto is dirt evil.
Mm-hmm.
They are putting their own financial well-being ahead of the well-being of the entire world. Ebenezer Scrooge wasn't that freaking evil. Seriously.
Yeah.
Lex Luthor had more of a heart than that. That's bad when comic book and fictional villains don't look as bad as you. Because they're created to be evil. You've evolved into this corporate ugliness.
Mm. Oh.
So, to contrast that, Michael Pollan goes to an organic farm, and he talks to a farmer there who grows a whole bunch of different varieties of tomatoes, or potatoes. And he asks him, I can't remember the guy's name, but he asks him and says, well, what do you do about worrying about blight or this or that? And he said, oh, I just grow a bunch of different varieties. Blight only affects russets. I have a bad year with russets. I have all these other types of potatoes to fall back on.
Exactly. Totally Mayan.
Yeah.
And also, too, because he does the crop rotation, he doesn't have as many problems with the potato beetles because it confuses them.
Yeah.
They won't realize that it's a beacon. Like, if it's a monoculture field that's only growing russets, of course they're always going to go there.
Because
it's like that diner that never goes away, that has been owned by generations and generations of the same family. You know to go there, you know there's going to be food. Mm-hmm. Same thing with potato beetles. But if you rotate the crop and put corn in there 1 year and potatoes in the next year.
And wheat, and then barley.
They're going to forget all about that, that there were even potatoes there.
Insects are smart, but they're not that smart, you know? So, it, again, I can see where he got from this book to some of the work he did in Omnivore's Dilemma with Crazy Farmer Guy.
Joe Salander, who actually has his own book out too, which we should check out.
We need to get that book. Awesome book, awesome guy. But I can see where he goes from this right into those thoughts that he had in Omnivore's Dilemma, especially from that last chapter.
Yeah.
That last chapter reads like a prelude to Omnivore's Dilemma.
Uh-huh.
So awesome. It reads like a prelude to Food, Inc. and everything else we've read since then. That made the book for me. It was so good. And Monsanto's evil. So I love reading about how evil they are, because they are. And seriously, if I became God of the Universe, that would be my first act. It would put them out of business, or at least put the Terminator gene out of business.
Yeah.
And to really crack repeal down
that
on what
court ruling that they can sit there and sue people over nature. Because
you can't control it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But anyways.
I think you could tell by my excitement throughout the episode. It was a really good read. Very informative. A lot of fun to sit down and thumb through. A nonfiction book. It didn't even take me 3 days to read it. I think it took me around the same time. It was a quick read. Worth picking up. You could pick it up anywhere from... We got it on sale because we had a coupon on Kobo Books. It's like $6-$7. You can get it maybe $10 tops.
Yeah.
So, anything else you want to add?
I don't think so. I think that's pretty much it.
This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila, and we are Zvi Fat Chicks. Thanks for listening.
We hope you enjoyed the Zvi Fat Chicks podcast. Please add us as a friend on Facebook and/or follow us on Twitter. You can email your comments, questions, or suggestions to zvifatchicks@gmail.com. That's zveifatchicks@gmail.com. Our theme music is Hot Swing by Kevin MacLeod. Our podcasts, like Mr. MacLeod's music, are protected under a Creative Commons attribute copyright. You can make copies of our shows and share them with friends. Please make sure that credit is given. Thanks for listening and have a great day.